Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Forecast is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Forecast is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/TWiT.
What sort of future do you think we're heading for? How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
Welcome to Forecast episode 90. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Scott Johnson.
Can you believe we're at episode 90, Scott?
No, I can't believe it. We're 10 episodes away from 100, Tom.
I know. I'm very happy to have some great guests with us to talk about their visions of the future today. New York Times bestselling author Ken Denmead, civil engineer, publisher, and editor of Geek Dad blog on Wired.com. And don't forget GeekMom.com as well.
Absolutely.
Great to have you along, Ken. Thanks for being with us.
Fantastic to be here. Thanks.
And John Kovalik, co-founder and co-owner of Out of the Box Games. He's on the creative team of Apples to Apples. You might also know him as the illustrator of Munchkin and the cartoonist behind Dork Tower. That's Dork Tower, not Dark Tower. Don't let my Midwestern accent fool you. John, welcome.
It's a pleasure being here.
It's great to have you both. You and Scott Johnson were reminiscing about old times before the show.
Yeah, having a fellow cartoonist on the show, one of renown, I should say. Dork Tower is a favorite of many people and such an early pioneer in webcomics that it's just really awesome. I mean, I came onto the scene like 2000. You were way ahead of me. So it's great to have us on here at the same time.
It's fun being here. Thanks. Yeah, I started around 95. My first comic was Wildlife, and then that evolved into Dork Tower in the mid-late 90s. And yes, I had never thought I'd be around this long.
Well, that's fantastic. And thanks for both of you being here. It's like having these two geeky polarity things happening, Tom. I can't imagine what our first question is today, but whatever it is, I'm sure we're going to get great feedback from both sides.
All right, let's start with a prediction from one of our listeners. Johan in Germany writes in and says, "Hi, Tom, Scott, and guests. In episode 88, Annika Jong envisions using a really advanced telescope to see in the past almost as far back as the Big Bang. What if we add interstellar travel at speeds faster than light to that? It would be great for historic research. If we wanted to know what the Earth was like 2,000 years ago, we take the super telescope and fly it to a point 2,000 light years away at warp 10, passing the actual light from that date. Then we point it to the Earth, and we can see exactly what went on."
Well, my Star Trek book says this is possible, but I don't know if it's a reality or not, if you could actually pull this off. I am no scientist in this regard, but it sure sounds cool to me. I love this idea.
Yeah, I love the idea. It sounds scientifically impossible, though, doesn't it, Ken?
Absolutely not. If science fiction has taught us anything, you know, anything is possible. But I think the whole shipping it, you know, 2,000 light years away to look back at us, that seems like almost too much work when we could take some sort of simply made, you know, unmanned aerial vehicle, unmanned space vehicle probe, just slingshot it around the sun into the past. It takes pictures of everything and then slingshots back the other way to come back to us.
Yeah, I watched Star Trek. That would work.
Exactly.
Right? Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. If we're living in the world of Trek, then this is certainly possible. But as Ken says, and I agree with this, most, if not all, the major, well, not all, but many of the major innovations that were imagined in Star Trek have sort of come to pass. We're still missing teleportation. We're still missing, like, food replicators. But the big stuff, the stuff that seemed crazy at the time in the 60s and in the Next Generation period, have all kind of come to us, and we have them in our pockets now, and we're doing a lot of the things that they were doing on Star Trek. So, sure, why not? Why not slingshot around and jump to the future?
John, is there any danger to gathering this stuff?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the big danger is being there at the spaceport when you come through customs, being there to greet yourself. That could just be embarrassing.
See, you have a lot of explaining to do. It's like, what did you pick up on your trip? Me.
Yeah. Well, I went to space and all I brought myself was my own stupid t-shirt.
Yeah, right.
If we learned anything from Time Cop, it's that you cannot occupy the same space at the same time. And
it'd be about 3 or 4 feet away.
Well, sure. But if you do accidentally touch yourself, like Ron Silver did in Time Cop, you will melt into gelatinous CGI purple goo. Just a warning to those out there who may be innovating in this space.
Thank goodness for movies.
TSA will probably take care of that soon enough. So,
right.
Actually, so never high five yourself.
They won't let you. They won't let you through the security line if you've melted into a gelatinous pile of goo, or at least more than 3 ounces.
Right. Yeah. Put yourself in a bag so you can go through.
All right, send us your predictions, folks, and we'll read them out. Email them to forecastpodcast, that's F-O-U-R, forecastpodcast@gmail.com, or post them up on our blog, forecastpodcast.com. Let's get into the short-term predicting. These are things you think will happen sooner rather than later. And, Ken, we'll start with you to my left. What do you see in the short-term future?
All right, so obviously at Geek Dad, we deal a lot with the family and technology. And everybody has a smartphone on them, a tablet on them, almost all times. We are almost universally 100% connected every hour of the day. And when it comes to the family, you know, that can be very distracting. If everybody's, you know, you're sitting watching TV after dinner or something, everybody's on their own laptop, they're on their own tablet, and, you know, maybe everyone's connected with the outside world, but you know, how's the family supposed to stay connected when they're distracted at all times? So I am predicting, because these devices exist, that somewhere in the next 5 to 10 years, someone is going to put out a device, and it will be a runaway hit. It will be a kill switch, some sort of interference device that everybody will have in the home. And when it's dinner time and it's time for everyone to sit down at the table, there's no, you know, turn off your devices, turn the TV off, whatever. It's just going to be one little device. Maybe they make it look like, you know, a nice pot that sits in the middle of the table, or it's the Lazy Susan or something. You hit the button, boom. All electromagnetic frequencies are blocked in the house. No connectivity during the dinner time.
The dinner EMP.
Wow. Exactly.
The DMP. Yeah, we have a rule at our house. I have a daughter who's 17, a daughter who's 14, and a son who's 11. And they, the girls, especially my oldest, has a really hard time putting her phone down when she wants to text at dinner. So we have this rule, no texting at dinner. But then the other night, I catch myself texting at dinner. In fact, I think I was texting Tom one night. And I'm just, you know, tacking away, not paying attention. And the girls have a fit because I'm breaking this rule because somehow I'm above the law or whatever. I kind of like the idea. Even if I'm in midstream, you know, unless it's some medical emergency or something, I like the idea. You could just flip a switch. John, what do you think of the idea of sort of this, giving parents the ability to just shut it down, forget about the rules, just turn it off?
I love it as long as you keep it simple. I've got a 3-year-old daughter now, and she can maneuver her way around an iPhone or an iPod like nobody's business. She is always going to be ahead of me. So I just want this to be a very simple switch, because in 10 years' time, whatever I've got, you know, technology-wise, is going to be doing the equivalent of flashing 12. And she is going to be there with a teleportation app on her iPod, you know, whatever the equivalent is. So, yeah, she is just going to be so far ahead of me. Just keep it simple for parents.
Just don't hit the button while she's in the middle of using the teleportation app, or we're back to Star Trek, the motion picture.
Right. And all of a sudden, you have two daughters.
Yeah.
You reflect. You got one in the buffer over there.
No, that's Riker. That was in Next Generation.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, sorry. I remember that.
You know, what is it that makes it so annoying when people are reading or texting or doing something at the dinner table? Because you're totally right. I mean, this is a thing that families have dealt with, you know, since before devices, for, you know, whether it's the television or the books. I'm just asking the question because I am also annoyed by it. But what is it that we want? Is it because we just want conversation and people paying attention?
We have this concept, and, you know, for right or wrong, that when you're together as the family, you're together. It's that quality time. It's, you know, we should be talking with each other. We should be connecting with each other. We should be having conversations and informing each other. And it's so easy. You take your family for granted in some ways. And it's so easy to be quickly distracted by someone else who is actually asking for your attention as well. I mean, I can, you know. One reason it's so hard is, even if you have your phone, and, you know, for me, it's in my pocket, it'll vibrate when someone has sent me an email or a tweet. That's a distraction. Why? Yeah, I should leave it in the other room. Oh, except that it's going to vibrate So I can actually hear it across the house. You know, oh, it's like anyone can hear the sound of a baby crying. You can hear the sound of your own phone vibrating somewhere, you know, 2 miles away.
My phone is calling to me.
Exactly. So, you know, I think we are so well outward connected. We want the ability to inward connect. And there's always, I think there's this golden ideal of, you know, intelligent family conversation around the dinner table. And it feels like something we've lost. And I think we keep fighting to get that back. And I, that's why I think, you know, the iKill will be the device that,
might need some marketing work. I'm not sure.
True. Yeah. Maybe not the best name.
No, this is a great idea. And we have in our house, we value our time around the table. And we figure that text to Tom, while maybe important on some subjective level, is not as important as finding out what Nick learned today, or why is that kid picking on him, or what he should do if he's getting picked on, or all these sort of life lessons that you get to have around dinner. I mean, we're big believers in it, but occasionally these things sort of sneak in. So just, I guess, to finish on this, what about those devices you can use in some hospitals now? Or I've heard of them being used maybe clandestinely in movie theaters, but there's a way to sort of just scramble everybody's signal in a certain radius. Basically, we have this technology today. Why aren't we using it in the home?
Precisely. Somebody just needs to pull it together, brand it appropriately, put it out there, and you'll sell millions.
I think when you're going out to eat, though, there's probably an argument for an etiquette of, like, there's a time in the, you know, in the pre-dinner when it's okay to check a message and you put it away for most of the dinner. And then after dessert service, maybe it's okay to pull it out for a brief check. You know, we need Emily Post to weigh in on this.
I would just like to jump in here and say, you guys are all on California time, right? Pacific?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mountain time for me.
I'm here in the Midwest, and my family's in having dinner right now. And I
ooh, wow. Big violation. Yeah. No no guesting on podcasts during dinner. Yeah. Obviously not a problem for you. All right. Well, let's move over to you, John. Your short-term prediction, something you think will happen maybe in the next few years or so. What do you got for us?
I think in the next five – okay, this is on the more of the social side rather than the technology side. My prediction is within the next 5-10 years, the web cartoonists and the print cartoonists will in fact be friends.
Oh, wow.
Peace in our time.
This is a bold statement right here. I mean, I have tried over the years, over the last decade of doing Extra Life and having it, you know, find its success and then be a thing that people like, to stay clear as I can from all the webcomic drama. But man, the webcomic world is so, it always surprises me how steeped in drama it is. And part of that drama now is this fierce fight between people putting stuff out purely digital and people who are still sort of sold on, you know, brick and mortar and paper, and the fact that they can't seem to find this weird common ground. So I would ask you, John, what will be the great moment of epiphany? When will they all go, oh, we don't need to fight?
It's going to be a gradual thing, but you're starting to see it now. A lot more print cartoonists are moving onto the web, or have got experience with PDF publishing, and many more of the successful web cartoonists are coming out with their own books. There's starting to be this, like, a big mash of people who do both. I've always done both. Dork Tower started as a print comic. It went online. It's now primarily known as a webcomic. I don't think of it as a webcomic. I don't think of myself as a web cartoonist. I think of myself as a cartoonist. It is hard enough to make a living as a cartoonist when you start out. And in general, I think despite all the drama of the webcomic, print comics things of the last few years, cartoonists tend to be a helpful bunch. Cartoonists mm-hmm. tend to like helping other cartoonists out on a personal level. So as long as we can move away from the tribalism, it's all cartooning.
Well, you just said it, and I think that this may be the moment, actually. When people hear this show and realize what we've done, we've made a very important distinction here, or you have, which is we're just cartoonists. Forget about web, forget about print. These are just the mediums where people can see our work, and they're really great mediums in their own right, and they both have their strengths and weaknesses. But really, you're just a cartoonist, and you're putting your stuff out there, and wherever you put it is all that matters, is that wherever people are consuming it, that they're able to. I think this may be our moment. This is our Geneva Convention. Let's do this.
There is never any point before where newspaper cartoonists got into fights with magazine cartoonists because those were the medium they were using. So the whole, I find it a very artificial distinction in the first place. I mean, there's obviously far more amateur work on the web than you'll find in newspapers. But on the other hand, there's a lot of mediocre stuff in the newspapers. But, you know, once you get up to the professional level, there's just so much fantastic work in both, on the web. There's still some great, really great cartoonists who are primarily print cartoonists, and it's all cartooning.
Well, will this start distinction go away anyway as we stop making the distinction between print and digital? I mean, that is going to happen, I think. Personally, yes. I think that's going to happen eventually anyway. So do you think that this piece will happen before that point, or will that be what kind of makes you go, you know, what is the difference?
No, I think it'll happen before then, definitely. You can make a joke that it's going to happen sooner or later because the newspapers are dying, which is a little sad. But I just think, my goodness, when Scott Kurtz, who is a wonderful, amazing guy, by the way, really talented, just a wonderful person, and Ted Rall, very famous editorial cartoonist, when they can sit down and have a drink, as they have, that's just the Nixon going to China moment of our field.
I'm not saying which one is Nixon. What do you think of the broader issue of print dying? I mean, I kind of feel like newspapers aren't dying. They're just morphing. But I'd like your opinion on that.
You know, I really think that there's a little bit of, I'm a big fan of Chris Anderson. He actually started the Geek Dad blog. Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief at Wired Magazine. And he wrote very very famously on the long tail there's always something out here on the end of the curve for everybody. And so I think right now we're seeing print diminish, but I don't think print will ever go away. In almost the same way that, you know what? They're making more LPs today than they were making 10 years ago.
And a lot of people thought television was going to kill the movies. Why would you ever go to a movie when you could have the video in your home? But it turns out there's advantages to both. And I think we'll find what those advantages are to print. And I don't think just because the web exists doesn't mean that news can never make money online.
Absolutely not. And, the price of doing print journalism is going down at the same speed that the cost of doing web journalism has always been very low. And so there are always going to be people that like it, that like print journalism, and there's always going to be a market for magazines and newspapers in some way, shape, or form. It's as long as the business models evolve to keep them profitable, which they will. And so, cartooning, there will always be a place for it in print. There will always be a place for it online. And whatever else amazing, beamed directly into our brains, whatever. It'll always be there.
Which brings me to the question for John, and I'd like to hear Scott's opinion on this too. John, do cartoons need newspapers going forward? Or will we eventually see a kind of a divergence where you just have a feed of your favorite cartoons and it's divorced from needing that daily carriage that it physically did need to come into your house every day in the past?
I think we're already past the point where cartoons need newspapers. We probably passed that point 5-10 years ago. There are a lot of, the best cartoonists in print are doing a lot of work online now. It's the artists, it's the creators controlling the means of distribution. The entire means of distribution is changing. It's obviously going to be a lot easier if you in the old days when you could get picked up by a syndicate and immediately be in 500 to 600 newspapers. There's a different way of working now. It's going to be a lot harder for some cartoonists. On the other hand, if you take a cartoonist like Kate Beaton, who is brilliant and young and just, her work is stunning. And she's become so popular so quickly because there's the opportunity to go viral. You'll have, strips like XKCD, which could never have been in a newspaper. The Oatmeal could never have really run in a newspaper. Maybe a few magazines might have picked it up. So I think we're past the point where newspapers are needed for the cartoons and cartoonists to thrive.
Yeah, they haven't been relevant for quite some time. And it's funny because I went from this bright-eyed kid out of high school and college who just could not wait to get syndicated so I could get my work in print. And that process was a nightmare, very small sort of gates with one gatekeeper and lots of people trying to get in. And we could talk about that all day. But it has all switched for me to become, I can't wait to get my work online so I can build an audience big enough where I can then sell printed work anyway. And that's kind of where cartoonists kind of control their own destiny. The other beauty is that so do the readers. If you want to read your favorite comics online, whether they be traditional print comics that also publish online or otherwise, we have great tools like RSS feeds and other stuff that let the user decide what they want, when they want it, and how they want to read it. So the tools are in the hands of the creators. The tools are in the hands of the readers. And I think that's a win for everybody.
Right. I beg your pardon.
No, go ahead.
You don't have to struggle through a dozen Mary Worths to get to Pearls Before Swine.
Right.
And that's a perfect example. But it's also, I love it when I get excited about a new collection going to print so I can sell it, because I know that there are going to be people who want that. I would want that. But I didn't have to get there through this narrow tunnel of, you know, millions of attempts to try to get into a syndication, get turned away at every turn, and then find out at the end of all of that that you're going to lose all control of your own property. You're not going to be able to edit your own work. And if they decide to take it and do something else with it, you're not necessarily going to get paid on the level you would if you controlled it. All of that's changed now. We own the space. And the only people really complaining out there about this move are ones that are so tied into the other space that they can't, you know, reach out. They're not being allowed to, either by their papers or their syndicates or whatever. That is all going to change. But as far as papers mattering, that's been a long time. I would say early 2000s, maybe still it mattered, but maybe even before that, the writing was on the wall.
All right, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, who also, there's writing on the wall, which is that I have to thank our sponsor. Netflix.com/twit is a place where I predict you will get 30 days free unlimited streaming of movies and TV shows, because you'll go there and you'll sign up. And that's what happens when you go to Netflix.com/twit. They give you 30 days free. And what you can find is amazing selection of movies and television shows, including the very movies that Scott Johnson talks about on his Film Sack podcast.
Indeed. In fact, this week we're doing The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, and I can't wait. And it's on Netflix streaming right now.
There you go. Check it out. And if you already have Netflix, but you know somebody who might take advantage of this, just give them the URL. That's the beauty of it. Nobody's going to know. Netflix.com/twit gives anybody a free 30-day trial. We thank them for their support of Forecast. Let's go to the long-term predictions. And John, we'll stick with you. Something that you see a little farther down the road, maybe 100 years, maybe longer. Who knows? What do you got?
Okay, 100 years. The computer games, electronic games, as we know, are going to change vastly, drastically. Probably nobody has any idea what we're going to be playing come a century from now. My prediction is traditional games, traditional board games, card games, will actually be more popular than ever in the United States. If the United States is even still here, wherever, they'll be extremely popular.
In the free economic zone of North America, board games.
Board games will be
more popular.
People will be playing the equivalents of Settlers of Catan, of Carcassonne. I don't think the actual experience of sitting down with a group of friends, moving pieces on a board or moving units on a table or laying down cards and watching their reaction as you skunk them, I don't think that's ever going to change. It's a very human activity, this gathering in a social group and laughing and enjoying each other's company. And I'm not sure. Electronic games are going to be huge. They're marvelous now. You can't tear me away from Mario Kart or Halo. But I don't think they will ever kill off traditional gaming. I think traditional gaming is just going to get stronger as technology moves.
It's interesting because we're already seeing this now. There's a resurgence in interest in board games and a lot of really interesting stuff, especially coming from Europe these days. And there are more and more conventions set up to support kind of an independent development of these games, as you. And I think it's on the rise already, and I completely agree with this. And in fact, it's interesting that the only thing I get more excited about than a good board game or a good card game with friends is when I hear that that game is coming to Xbox Live Arcade or some other new way to play that awesome game I like. So that will even continue to bleed into real video games, and those will become great experiences in their own right. But absolutely, this is kind of. And do you agree? Do you think board games are here to stay?
Ken, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. I was at PAX Prime a couple of weekends ago. One of the most dynamic and enjoyable conventions that you can go to, the Penny Arcade Expo up in Seattle. And it's half video games and it's half board games and card games. And, you know, it far be it from Never the Twain Shall Meet, they meet and they have a lot of fun together. I can almost imagine, though, that as with so many other things, eventually the differences will go away. And, you know, I could totally see within 100 years, we will have holographic boards with, little holographic cards or cards that can generate whatever you want to see on them so that you will have one board game set. And it will, you know, oh, I want to play Catan today. Boom, hit the button, zzz, Catan comes out. And you have Catan cards and you have all of that stuff. And then suddenly, you know, next day you want to play Carcassonne or you want to play any of the amazing things. I mean, there are so many wonderful games coming out now. We were at PAX. A couple of the coolest things I saw were, the folks that do Settlers of Catan have their own special Catan table for playing the game. And there's the Geek Chic folks that have just some of the most beautiful gaming furniture that you can imagine. And I can see all of that getting integrated with, you know, three or four generations down the road, Microsoft Surface or whatever. And you will have a game center in your home that can literally do anything, holographic, multimedia, all of it. And so it won't be a matter so much of just card games and video games. It'll just be games.
Yeah, I was at Dragon Con in Atlanta last weekend. Much like PAX Prime, has this huge gaming area that takes up the entire floor of a hotel in the basement of the Marriott. And people playing tabletop games as far as the eye can see, very enthusiastic about it, enjoying the hell out of it. So I think you're right, John. I mean, that games are not tabletop games, board games are not going anywhere. The question is, how popular can they get? Because of not only video games, but the numerous ways of entertaining ourselves that are now competing. I've always been of the idea that one of the reasons we see a decline in television ratings and people going to the movies, in people buying music, is because we have so many other ways to entertain ourselves. So it's sort of a, you know, would it end up being a Pyrrhic victory where they end up, board games do become most popular, but they're actually less popular than they've ever been historically?
I think they'll become more popular than they've ever been historically, especially in North America. If you go to a country like Germany, the greatest games convention in the world is in Essen. It's called Spiel. It's probably the trade floor is probably a good 5 to maybe 10 times that of Gen Con. Gaming as a social activity is very ingrained into German social free time. So I think we're just starting to see that here in the States, we're on the cusp of really appreciating the vast range of amazing games that are out there. And this isn't so much for things like PAX Prime, Gen Con, Dragon Con. This crowd is always known these games exist. This is more, you're starting to see Settlers of Catan and Carcassonne in places like Target and some Walmarts. So I think there's a huge potential for growth here. And I just think it's the games we've had here in the U.S., for the most part, you'd get Monopoly for Christmas, or you'd get Happy Days, or more recently, various trivia games based on TV shows. These have not been great games. Now, around Christmas time, you'll start to see in the malls, in the stores, Just a really nice selection of quality games. The kind of games you want to go back to again and again, the kind of games you want to be with friends, laughing about, and enjoying.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point that tabletop games, board games, do not compete for a limited amount of attention. They're their own thing, and people can enjoy them as their own experience. Television didn't run them out of business. Movies didn't run them out of business. There's no reason to think that video games would. And you're right, man. Settlers of Catan, people who get into that from all stripes, it's not just geeks, you know, they get addicted and really get sucked in. It's a hell of a game.
You know, I'll point out, you know, I wanted to point out one of the interesting trends is something like, you know, I'm assuming as being good geeks, we've all played our share of Dungeons and Dragons over the years. And I think it's been really fascinating to watch Wizards of the Coast put out board game versions of D&D as sort of these bridge things to attract people who are comfortable with board games, not necessarily yet comfortable with RPGs. But they're bringing them along, and you're using simplified sets of the rules, but still getting the effect of rolling the dice and having some form of a character sheet and having figures that represent the monsters and represent the people. And so there's so much more imagination being put into bringing these things to the popular culture in the United States now, where, I mean, I remember growing up going to a hobby store, you could see all those really fancy looking box sets of these exotic European games. And, you know, they were mysterious back then. Now they're fascinating and they're coming into the home.
All right, let's move over to your long-term prediction, Ken, something of the flying car variety, perhaps something like that. What do you got for us?
Okay, so we, a little bit on the pre-show, we're talking about how, you know, any good podcast will get you to sort of yell back at your listening device or your car stereo or whatever, going, God, you forgot this. And I feel that way towards the Forecast podcast. There have been a number of episodes I've listened to where I just like, you know, you guys missed something really obvious.
We're just glad you listened.
There you go, yeah. those three listens, that's me. Yeah. So I wanted to bring back up energy decentralization.
All right.
Now, the idea that at some point, and I think this is almost inevitable, except for, you know, whatever big company, horrible Illuminati conspiracies will try to regulate it away, is I think it really should be inevitable that we will have homes providing their own power plus surplus sometime in the next 50 to 100 years. It started out, I started seriously thinking about this back when I was having a little, you know, personal political hot flash, thinking about a certain war in the last decade that cost a lot of money for very little positive outcome, and sat down one day on the back of a napkin and worked out the fact that the money spent at that point on that conflict would have paid for an installation of solar power to every home in the United States.
Wow.
Enough power to power each and every home in the United States based on that current technology, which, you know, worked out to about $20,000 to $25,000 per household to generate a couple of kilowatts. So if you can imagine, knowing how quickly, first of all, solar power technology is getting towards that point of being competitive with other forms of energy production, and also considering where the energy consumption technologies are going in terms of, you know, the fascinating LED bulbs that look to probably overtake compact fluorescence and become the main form of our lighting in our homes. You can figure out then that we'll have electric cars, we will have electric heating, we will have all of it. If you had everything electrical, you had 2 to 3 kilowatt power generation in your house, and you had some sort of hybrid of batteries and the fancy capacitors that are sort of coming about, milling off in the near future right now. There is no way that every home in the United States, every apartment building, could not be generating enough power for itself, plus enough to feed back to the grid. That there would be net surplus, so that, you know, during the day, The houses are all either stored up themselves and hopefully feeding the businesses that need excess power. And then at night, you know, there's enough battery backup and whatever. And, you know, the solar technology is actually so amazing. I have right here at my desk this cool Logitech solar keyboard that I've been testing for a little while. It's a completely solar powered, and I can use it indoors all the time, and it's never running out of power.
Well, that's awesome. So I got. So here's my question. Private okay. sector generated or government generated? Who gets there first?
Private. I hope private. And I think it will be private because right now that's where all the energy and focus is. I think, you know, there's enough of these small companies right now that try to find that magic equation between what the government tax incentives and subsidies are and pay, you know, signing up people. You pay, you know, a homeowner pays $5,000 or $10,000. These guys put the solar thing in, and then you pay maybe 75% of what your normal power bill is. You pay that to this third party company, and you get solar power for, you know, a 20-year lease or something like that. Obviously, right now those are the hoops that they're jumping through. I think as the technology gets better, those are the companies that will be jumping on every new stage, every new iteration, and trying to get it out there and into the homes. I think there is a desire. I think there's a real desire in homes all over the United States that we want this. I mean, just the idea of how disruptive it would be if everybody felt self-sufficient in the power needs in their home. I think that it has to happen. I think it really will happen. It's just a matter of how it evolves politically and economically.
Yeah, there's that hump to get over for individuals as well as the entire country, the entire world, of how do we pay to get there? I think everybody wants to get there, right? They want that right. self-sufficiency. But it's a question of, well, do I want to get into a situation where I'm, you know, have a monthly payment to a company for an extended period of time? Do I have enough to put this down? Do I want to go through the trouble of having the stuff put up on my house, even though I really want the outcome?
Right.
Those are just a few of the things, and batteries right. and capacitor technology that right. you're talking about.
But really, yeah,
but yeah, I think you're right. So that everybody wants to get there.
Yeah, so I think that 50-year timeline, something like that. Once A, it gets cheap enough, and B, it gets easy enough to install, it's a no-brainer. As you know, when it comes down to installing your whole home solar/wind hybrid power generation facility, becomes as easy and, you know, painful as getting the cable installer to come out.
Oh, geez, yeah.
You know, if we're willing to suffer that right, level right. of pain, you know, that's I think that's our line to cross.
Would John, would this kind of situation work for you? Because solar, I mean, it's not a one size fits all situation. Solar is not going to work for everybody. It's going to work for a lot of people, though.
We have sun here in the Midwest sometimes.
You got enough.
It's yeah, we have enough.
In the winter though. You've got it filtered.
Well, yeah. When we need it the most. To me it's just heartening hearing Ken talk about this. To me the change seems so gradual. You want this all to arrive so quickly. It just, you know, you hate seeing anything go out of business, but when the Hummers packed up shop and you started seeing smart cars, not a lot of smart cars, but some smart cars here and there around Madison, that was just a great moment for me. I'm just hoping for anything at this point.
Can you hang on for 50 years?
I'm not sure if I can, but it's that's up to my daughter at that point, I think.
Yeah. No, as a long-term prediction, Ken, I think you're absolutely right. I think I'm not sure exactly what form it'll take, whether it'll be solar, wind, combo, something totally new.
Yeah, hybridization, and who knows.
But yeah, I think we will get there. All right, let's get crazy now. One really far out there forecast, your crazy-ass prediction, Ken, we'll start with you.
All right. In 1,000 years, in some mysterious, crazy, I'm thinking Ferengified future. if everybody groks,
there will no longer be Latin future. Got it
exactly. Right. There will be no nationalities anymore.
Well, we wouldn't be very Ferengified then. Well, I guess like the species.
Well, no, here, hold on, hear me.
Yeah, okay.
So there will be no nations. There will be only corporations. We will have no nationality. We will be our own corporations.
Oh, you went all Neal Stephenson on me.
Exactly. And so what? Everyone is a corporation. We all have stock. We will all offer stock in ourselves. So instead of going to work for another big conglomerate and earning your paycheck every month or whatever, you will tender a stock offering. And whichever corporation will buy a large enough set of shares at a high enough price to basically own a portion of you for a period of time wins, and that is what your salary is.
Putting and the so, I in IPO.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, basically that means wealth will no longer be calculated by how much money you have, but by your share price and by your net, you know.
And so how much does that stuff fluctuate? Like, does it change all the time? Are we going to deal with, like,
We will all exist on a global or galactic stock market, and our value from day to day can be based on, you know what, did you clip someone driving to work today? Well, did they, you know, scan your thing and post something nasty on Super Twitter, and then all of a sudden your share price just went down 3% because people think you're a jerk. And so,
wow.
And if you're having a real good, you know, couple of years, well, maybe it's time to tender a second set of shares so that you can afford that retirement home.
Wow. And you went to the doctor, you got high cholesterol. Oh, good today on dude with high cholesterol.
Exactly, exactly.
Wow. All right.
John,
offer your insurance company a few extra to keep you on.
Yeah. This is a pretty cool idea for a future, but also a book and movie. So hopefully somebody will get on this if we haven't already. John, what do you think about a future where your value is tied directly to how you are being valued by others?
In many ways, my career is already there.
You are living in the future, sir.
I am ahead of my time, apparently.
All right, let's turn to you for your crazy-ass prediction. Time frame doesn't matter. Just take the leap. What do you got for us?
Okay, in either 602 years or
like
2 years, beatniks will be the predominant social clique.
Oh, man.
I thought this was going to happen in the 90s, so I'm still hopeful.
Here's how I know this to be true. I call this the circle of scorn. We have currently hipsters are the main group receiving worldwide social scorn. Hipsters replaced yuppies. Mm-hmm. Yuppies replaced preppies. Preppies replaced hippies. Mm-hmm. Hippies replaced yippies. Yippies replaced beatniks. And beatniks replaced hipsters.
Oh, we're back. It's
Is that
cycle.
Right? Do beatniks replace hipsters? I hadn't realized that.
Wow. It's having a Mufasa moment here. Major circle of life.
The circle of scorn. And it's roughly a 60-year period. And so we are looking at the new... We are on the cusp of a new beatnik era.
What were the hipsters of the late 40s, early 50s like?
Zoot suits.
Okay. That was their version of skinny jeans.
And
well, they had the long keys on the long chains back then, right?
Yeah,
It's all come back full circle, right?
Right. Okay, wow. I could see this. I'm a big fan of cycles, finding those kind of patterns. So I'm with you on this one, Scott.
Wasn't there a lot of sort of poetry, like stomp, kind of weird stuff going on in like bars and tea houses and stuff with beatniks? Do I have that? Do I have them assigned improperly? But that's right.
Beat poetry.
Yeah. Is it invest? All I can say, gentlemen, is invest in berets.
And just remember, black is the new black.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Absolutely. All right. If you've taken nothing else from this episode, you will become rich by investing in berets. And you can thank John for that. I think it's time we better get to four questions, Scott.
Four questions. It's where we ask our guests four questions. Four questions rapid fire style. And we're going to do it now. I'm going to ask Ken my questions. Ken, are you sitting comfortably for your four questions?
No, but that will help me.
Awesome. Don't think too hard either. Here we go.
Gives you the edge.
How big of an impact will the Geek Dad blog have on your kids in the future?
significant, since hopefully it's going to help him go to college.
Good answer.
Good answer. In the great milk shortage of 2056, what will you soak your Frosted Flakes in?
Almond milk.
Mm. Oh, yum!
I drink it now. I just, you know, little extra sweetener, a little bit of vanilla, and some bourbon, and it's perfect.
And the bourbon, right?
Just a touch of bourbon for flavor.
Yeah, exactly.
What represents a greater threat to humanity: robot horses or sentient toasters?
Robot horses or sentient toasters?
Yes.
Obviously, the toasters. Because they will willfully ruin all of our breakfast foods and therefore cause a global famine.
Now, if Scott meant Cylons by sentient toasters, it was as a disparaging remark. Would that change your answer, Eddie?
Of course not, because there are no Cylons.
Right. All right. Of course.
They are a myth.
What am I talking about?
I'm still pretty...
My back is not good.
Horses made out of robots still scares me. Anyway, okay. Last question. Yeah. Hoverboards, hover bikes, or hover cars?
Yes.
No,
correct answer.
I want hover surfboards. I want hover yoga mats. Hover any. You know, if you're going to have hover, just, you know, I want a hover house. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Hover everything.
If you can hover something, damn well hover everything.
I agree. All right. I'm in 100% agreement.
Well done. Tom, your question's for John now.
All right, John, are you sitting comfortably?
As comfortably as I can.
Good, then we'll begin. Question number one, how many more Star Wars editions will we suffer through, and what will be an example of further alterations?
No.
Well, the main alteration is they're going to stop focusing on the 3D for the movies, and they're going to start focusing on the fact that there are so many 1D characters.
So we'll get a 1D version?
You'll get a 1D version.
In the future.
Yes, to match the characters.
By the way, tip of the hat to you for your Pray I Don't Alter Them Further cartoon the other day.
Thank you so much.
That was good.
Yeah, that was a good one. Question number two. In the great milk shortage of 2056... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm reading Scott's question. Question number two from me. Percentage chance of John Scully returning to Apple?
Vodka. Oh, I'm sorry. That was the answer to a
question. But a good answer.
Oddly, it works in both cases.
And this would be an anticipation of the Newton 2.
Yeah, it's one of those cycles questions, right? Newton 2, exactly.
It's got a little bit of the preppy thing going on. So I'd say 12 years by my cycle, something along those lines.
Yeah, Scully just has to hold on for 12 years. Question number three, will humanity ever suffer a science fiction channel to live?
I hope not. Though it depends. Does this science fiction channel of which you speak actually show science fiction?
Yeah, and it will keep its name to involve somehow science fiction in the name.
It will not seem to be a disease that one could have caught in the 1800s.
So still hope not?
I've had to back off from some of those cartoons because they just would have taken over the strip. They're going to be more next week.
And question number four, when the aliens finally arrive, what will be our first message to them?
Vodka. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry or vodka?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Vodka? Maybe you can combine them.
I'm sorry. I thought you wanted gin. No, just,
so
just
we want space vodka.
Just a blank. Welcome to Earth. Sorry about the mess.
Really sorry. I am a fan of space vodka as well. Good alternate answer. All right, that's it. Thank you guys so much. This has been a really fun episode. I really appreciate you guys playing along.
Hey, this was a ton of fun. I've been looking forward to this forever.
It's wonderful. Thanks so much for having us.
Ken, you are, of course, a New York Times bestselling author and civil engineer, publisher, and editor of the Geek Dad blog. Let folks know where they can find the Geek Dad blog and all the other things you do online.
All right, geekdad.com. Also, check out the companion site, geekmom.com. You can find us on Twitter at WiredGeekDad. I personally am at FitzWillie. And for my books, geekdadbook.com. I have a new book coming out in November, the Geek Dad Book for Aspiring Mad Scientists. So please check it out.
Awesome. Yeah.
Available for pre-order now.
Excellent. All right. I'll definitely keep an eye out for that. And John, too many things to count. Where do people keep up with all the stuff you do?
Dorktower.com, D-O-R-K, tower.com is probably the safest place to start. I'm on Twitter, muskrat_John. Worldofmunchkin.com is for all things Munchkin. And upcoming projects, the new issue of the Dork Tower comic book will be coming out in November as a PDF first. And the next collection of Dork Tower has been long delayed, but that will be out soon after. So, yay.
Ah, definitely looking forward to that as well. Scott Johnson, what more can we say? These guys were great.
Awesome guests. I can't say enough about having those guys on. And I would just I would tell people to direct their attention toward currentgeek.com this week. I think we have a pretty cool article coming up. It's another show Tom and I do, a little short form show, and I need to bring it to people on Wednesday. So watch for that at currentgeek.com.
I'm looking forward to that too. What's the article?
I don't even know. I have to look at it.
All right, that's it for this edition of Forecast, folks. You can email us with your predictions, and we'll always read at least one of them on the show, and we read all of them silently to ourselves. Forecastpodcast@gmail.com is the email address, and you can post comments up at our website, forecastpodcast.com. We will see you next time on episode 91. Until then, take care.
Bye. Way.
Way.
Complete!